lives into your life. It wasn't much of a stretch to start to see all of the little miracles that otherwise went unnoticed every day. The inner city became a red brick miracle, the suburbs a wisteria-covered wonderland, fit for any Alice who tried to find it. So even if Damiola was dead, maybe his part wasn't over in all of this. It was somewhere to start again, but this time he wasn't about to run out into the middle of the night. He went downstairs and wrote a note for his mother, telling her not to worry, which of course guaranteed she would, and called a cab to take him across London. 20 minutes later, Josh stood outside the run-down old cemetery, feeling woefully underdressed for the cold. The magician had given up his vigil at the gates. Josh stepped between the lopsided raven's wings. The cemetery at night was a very different animal to the cemetery by day. The shadows of the dead clung to the dark places, lending the old stones the feel of perdition. Walking down the gravel path, it was easy to imagine the lost souls trapped within the cemetery's crumbling walls, unrepentant even as their eternal torment began in earnest, their cries being drawn out of their dead lips, even as the gravel crunched beneath his feet. But perhaps that was just the wind. He resisted the urge to call out. If the magician were here, he wouldn't take kindly to being summoned in that manner. Instead, he walked among the gravestones, his breath becoming louder in his ears with each step, until it drowned out the crunch of gravel underfoot. The specter of the mausoleum rose out of the shadows ahead of him. The moonlight transformed what had been a modest structure into an imposing house of the dead. The gates still hung open, though they lacked the ornamentation they once had, thanks to Damiola's defensive magic. The bird he'd conjured forth from them was reduced to a tangled heap of wrought iron on the grass. Behind it, the door to the tomb itself was still open a crack, the ancient oak embossed onto the door, casting deeper shadows around the lock. There was nothing to suggest that the magician had survived the showdown with Seth's comedians, but plenty to intimate that he hadn't. He was sure he could smell blood on the air as he pushed the door open wide. So many things begin with something as simple as opening a door. It wasn't just a clumsy metaphor for life's choices. It was more than that. There was the fear of what lurked on the other side of a closed door, or what made those sounds in the night. There was the hope that went with the idea that stepping through could lead to something different, somewhere new. There was the belief that somehow the door protected you from the outside world, and the knowledge that it didn't. Josh went inside. The passageway leading down to the chamber beyond was dark. There was a vague flickering light at the far end. No doubt that was another metaphor for the path he was on, Josh thought, as he descended the few steps into the tomb proper. He heard labored breathing in the darkness up ahead. He walked cautiously toward the light, not sure what he expected to find waiting for him there. This time he did call out, just the one word. Hello? The call went unanswered. He walked slowly toward the light, entering the tomb. For a moment he thought it was empty. The single source of light, a guttering candle stub that didn't seem to burn down, despite the fact the wick was buried in less than a fingernail of wax, reflected in the steel toe cap of a worn-out boot that stuck out from beneath a pile of rags. Cadmus Damiola was a broken man, beaten, battered, and cast aside by the comedians before they came after Josh. He lay now beneath layers upon layers of grimy and filth-ridden coats that shrouded his ruined body. The magician looked up. He didn't seem surprised by the intrusion, as he said,
"You again?"
"You're not dead," Josh said.
"I am. I told you. 1929. It says so on the door. It's just taken a while to catch up with me."
He held out a hand. Josh could see dark lines that at first he mistook for fine hairs across the back of it, until he saw them for what they really were. Cracks.
"I'm coming apart,"
Damiola explained. No fear in his voice, only resignation.
"It can't be helped. Death is catching up with me after all these years. I'm done. Now it's only a matter of how long before I unravel. Leave me be. I'm too tired for all of this. I've told you what needs doing. It's your fight now. Seth has bested me for the last time. There are only so many times you can get knocked down and get back up again. I don't have the indignation to go down fighting. I'm done. I'm out. Just leave me alone.
I've been there, Josh said. Not exactly a protest, not exactly begging the old man for help, but hoping those three words would catch his interest. That had been the point, after all, hadn't it? By giving him the compact and telling him where to go, Damiola had been guiding him to the hidden city within the city. He wanted him to tear the illusion down, to find a way to save the girl. I've been into Glasstown. Josh held out the gold compact. That's what you wanted me to do, wasn't it? Find your workshop. Find the way through to the other side. His lips were suddenly dry. He crouched down beside the magician. When I went back to try and find another way in, it didn't work. The mirror didn't show me the way. I didn't know what else to do apart from come here to find you. Damiola shook his head.
Impossible.
Josh didn't know if he meant it was impossible that he'd set foot in the hidden city, or that it was impossible that the mirror hadn't revealed a second way into him. I know how it works, Josh pressed on. I know that it messes with time.
You don't understand what you are talking about, do you? It's all just words to you.
I might not know how it does it, but I was in there for a few minutes, inside Glasstown, and when I came out the other side, a week had passed. I know how it works, how you hid them from Isaiah. That stopped the magician's denials. He didn't say anything for the longest time, and when he did finally make to speak, a vicious bout of coughing rattled his old bones. He wiped the spittle from his lips with grubby fingers. It was a full 10 seconds before he said,
I thought the anchors dilated time, like an optical, spatial, and temporal illusion. City within a city, hidden behind glass. An hour within a month, a year within 100, all coming together to slow the passage of time. But I was wrong. It was so much more than that. They keep the way through the veil into the other world closed on this side, but open on the other.
The Anwen, Josh said, as though he understood. It was a convincing lie.
Perhaps you aren't as clueless as you look, dear boy. Yes, the Anwen, the druidic otherworld, the underworld, Maitlan, Narika, Dayu, Duzak, the Lake of Fire, the Outer Darkness. What we now call Hell was so much more in the understanding of our ancestors. I didn't know, not at first. I was naive enough to think it was my masterpiece, that I was in control, that I had fashioned a miracle, not tapped into a nightmare. But in reality, it was just a prison.
The magician hawked and spat in disgust.
It was such an amazing feat. The sum of my life's work, bringing two phases of existence together. And for what? So that bastard could escape from his crimes and live happily ever after? What a travesty.
Then help me. Help me stop him.
You can't beat the devil, boy.
He's not the devil. He's a lunatic.
Oh, no, no. He's so much more than that. He doesn't need horns. He has the heart of Lucifer inside him.
If you've already given up, why did you give me the compact? Why did you send me to your workshop?
Honest answer. To keep the glass out of Lockwood's hands.
Damiola explained, shuffling his back up against the wall. The cracks in his neck and cheek were deeper and more pronounced than they had been a few seconds ago.
It was only ever about getting the glass away from me, while his playthings were so close. All these years he'd left me alone. I'm sure he thought I was dead. Now he knows I'm not. Those freaks of his will have spilled their guts as soon as they reported back to him.
They never made it back. There was an accident. They got hit by a bus.
That wouldn't have stopped them, the magician said.
It did.
No, the magician shook his head. The only thing that could have stopped them would be Lockwood snuffing their light out. As long as that flame keeps on burning, they live.
They're gone.
Then he made a mistake.
That's good, isn't it? Proves he's not unbeatable.
It just proves he's impatient, the magician said.
And that's something we can use against him, Josh said. Just help me. Tell me how to fight him.
I already did. I told you his weakness. He's obsessed with the woman. It's beyond desire. He needs to possess her. The problem is what it means for her, that woman he took, Eleanor. To beat him, you damn her. Is that a consequence you are willing to face? If it is, you know what to do.
There must be another way.
If you've been there, you understand. You know what I am saying. Beyond the glass, 1 year passes as 100. You were gone barely 15 minutes if you lost a week. Eleanor Raines is almost a year older than when he took her. She's still the same vibrant young woman he ripped out of time.
But that's good, isn't it?
It means she can never leave the other place.
She can, Josh protested. She was at my grandfather's funeral. I saw her again not far from here.
I'm not making myself clear. She can't leave what you call Glasstown without the universe making moves to protect itself. It's bigger than her now. The world as we know it is a delicate ecosystem. Eleanor Raines doesn't belong here. She is intrinsically linked to the London of the 1920s. That is her place in space and time. Take her out of it, and you create an absence. An Eleanor Raines-shaped hole in the universe. If you then put her here, now, in the London of today, that creates a fault line between then and now.
He lifted his hand again.
Like these. But instead of being limited to one man's frail body, they are all around you. Cracks in the here and now as time looks to reassert itself. Her being here creates paradoxes by the minute. Think of reality as a sheet of glass, and all of those paradoxes are little hairline fissures in it. It doesn't take a lot to shatter it. Her being here is like taking a hammer to that glass. It is as simple as that.
The magician shuffled up against the wall, using it to help himself stand. He was weak despite the absence of any obvious wounds beyond the cracks in his skin. He leaned on Josh for support.
Existing outside the Anwen, even for a few minutes, is enough for the whole thing to start unraveling. She can't come back. The consequences are too much to bear.
The magician snuffed out the stub of candle, but the tomb didn't go dark. There was a second source of light, Josh realized, as Damiola brought forth a ghost with the slightest turn of his right hand and index finger. It looked like Eleanor, exactly like her, save for the fact that her red dress had a vaporous hue, no solidity or substance to it. The conjuration was absolutely still. Josh could see straight through her to the wall behind her. The red light cast an ashen glow across the magician's face. Damiola coughed, phlegm rasping at the back of his throat wetly. Josh didn't know how the old man was doing it, some sort of optical illusion. That was how he did everything, wasn't it? Mirrors, with or without smoke. The woman slowly turned in place to face Josh, and as she did, she began to crumble. It began as a single black crack through her cheek, then another and a third, as her complexion was ruined. The cracks became a web of black lines.
"Time forces itself to catch up with her," Damiola explained, as the ghost aged rapidly, her youthful beauty replaced by a hard-worn middle age, which crumbled into those twilight years in a matter of seconds. "The reality is that Eleanor Raines is over 100 years old. She can't be here and not be over 100 years old. It doesn't work like that, and people don't live to that kind of age. 70, 80, 90, maybe, but there's a limit. No one lives forever, not even me. And what happens then? The natural order reasserts itself. There's no other way this ends for her."
"There must be."
"Why? Because you want one. Because it's unfair. Because of Seth. He is out here now, in our London, coming and going as he pleases. He hasn't turned to dust. He's not aging like that. He's just him." "Then he's never left the safety of the illusion." "He has. I've seen him. He was at the funeral. He threatened me afterward. He was there when I stepped out of Glasstown a week after I set foot in it, waiting. He's spending a lot of time outside of the safety of the illusion.
Maybe he cut his heart out and keeps it buried in a lead-lined box, beating away," Damiola said.
Josh couldn't tell if he was entirely joking.
"Would that work?"
"I don't know. I don't know everything, lad. I'm not ineffable. I didn't create that world. I only opened the door."
"What if I kill him?"
"Hard to do if his heart's in a box," Damiola said, offering a wry smile. "But, assuming it isn't, it won't change a thing. And to be honest, it could do more harm than good. You don't know what the effect of spilling blood in there will do. Blood is strange. It carries the essence of life in it, and the essence of life is time."
"You say that like it's a bad thing."
"I know it can't be a good thing. That is enough. Everything is connected. I don't know how quickly it will happen. Hours, days, maybe, but it will happen. So to beat Seth, you shatter the anchors, allowing the door into that other place to close once and forever, bringing about an end to Glasstown. And you win. The years will race in to fill the void, catching up with themselves. Look at her face. Look at what's happening to her."
This time, as the ghost of Eleanor flickered, the cracks widened to finger-thick fissures now. Its light went out like a pinched flame, casting them in darkness. The silence in the tomb was absolute.
"There must be another way,"
Josh said finally.
"You either break them all and shatter the illusion forever. No going back. Let time take both of them. Or you repair the broken anchor by using the glass from the compact.
It's the same stuff that I used to push Glasstown into the underworld in the first place, and the only piece of glass that remains. And in doing so, trap her in that place for another 100 years, or however long it takes for the anchors to finally fail. The world will have forgotten all about both of them, and us. So at least you won't have to watch it happen. But it is going to happen. So, what is it to be?
36. Friends like these. Julie Gennaro was in over his head, and thanks to the Lockwoods learning a very important life lesson. You didn't need water to drown. You could do that just fine on dry land. He looked up at the windows of Joshua Raines's Rotherhithe flat. There was no obvious way in apart from the front door, which suited him just fine. He'd taken something from the evidence room at the station, a bump key. The science behind it was pretty simple. All he had to do was slip the key into the lock, bump it hard, once, maybe twice, and fool the tumblers into thinking they'd been tripped, and that was that. It was an essential bit of every thieves' kit. The skill was in fashioning the key, not using it. The principle was simple enough. By not sliding the key all the way in, there was one pin at the end that wasn't tripped. And when the key was bumped, it forced it deeper into the keyway. The specially designed teeth worked to fool the pins, and the lock thought it had been opened. It only took a second, and done right, barely left a trace on the barrel. As he walked up to the door, Julie couldn't help but glance back over his shoulder, just the once, to see if anyone was watching. It wasn't exactly the behavior of an invited guest, but he'd done it before he could stop himself. It was still a couple of insomniac hours before the dawn chorus, so he was banking on the fact that there was no one around but the birds to see him acting like an idiot. He shuffled up to the door and did the trick with the bump key, praying it would work. It did. He opened the door quickly and closed it behind him without looking back. The hallway smelled musty. He hadn't noticed it the first time. He'd been too busy trying to take in the craziness of the Raines family obsession, struck by the sadness of generations of men never getting over the kidnap of the woman they were named after. He stepped through the sea of unopened mail, newspapers, and gaudy flyers and restaurant menus, then climbed the stairs 2 and 3 at a time to the top. He wanted to be in and out quickly, less chance of being caught. As he reached the top of the stairs, he was struck by how little thought he'd given the crime. Lockwood wanted him to convince Josh to let it go, but how was he supposed to do that? This thing, the story of Eleanor Raines, had clearly obsessed his family for generations. It wasn't as if he could just lean on the guy and say it'd be bad for his health, like some dodgy scene in a gangster movie. He needed to be cleverer than that. And that was hard, because right now his brain wasn't working properly. The key to stopping Lockwood had to be in one of these rooms. He was banking his life on it. That was what Josh Raines had been trying to tell him when he'd brought him here, and again when he'd dragged him out to that empty street at the other end of the city, wasn't it? Julie needed him to be right. But facing the sheer mass of information gathered in the flat, it quickly became obvious that the problem was identifying that single piece of information amid all of the madness. He needed to think smart, use the time here alone to really get a grasp of everything on those walls. The first time he'd skimmed stuff, his mind already made up, even before he ducked under the first red thread to read about some long-forgotten stage act, a bunch of long-dead East End villains, and weird ancient mythology. Between then and now, he'd come face to face with celluloid sex demons and murdered his own partner. Everything was different now. He needed to absorb it all, let it wash over him, lose himself in it in the same way that Josh had obviously done in that week he'd disappeared. But he didn't have a week. He wasn't even sure he had until sunrise. Where to start? He looked around for something, an image, a headline, something that would serve as a cipher to unlock the whole puzzle, and chose a photograph of Eleanor Raines, He crossed the bare floorboards with their scorched-in map of London, ducking under the cat's cradle of red threads linking the articles and images, and spent a full minute just staring at the woman. He stood on the scorched words, one for one. They didn't mean anything to him, so he ignored them. There were enough things he didn't understand without worrying about three little words. There was no getting away from the fact that she was beautiful. Not modern beautiful, not heroin chic or Hollywood plastic. Properly beautiful, timelessly beautiful. It wasn't hard to imagine two men becoming so utterly obsessed with her they went to war. Men had gone to war over less. He followed the red thread from her portrait to an article mentioning the entrepreneur Reuben Glass and his failed attempt to get a movie town established in the East End, which was where a young director by the name of Hitchcock was looking to shoot many of the scenes of his first movie, Number 13. Glass, it seemed, was heavily invested in the success of the young director's first movie. Until today, yesterday now, Julie had never even heard of it. The article was dated more than a decade after the disappearance of Eleanor Raines, but that wasn't what caught his eye. It was a reference to a coup the young director had tried to pull off, a cameo from none other than the Hollywood goddess Myrna Shepherd. According to the reporter, there was no proof that she'd ever been on set, and with the film itself lost, no way of ever knowing, as Hitch refused to talk about Number 13, save to say that it wasn't very good. Did a sex demon with Shepherd's face feasting on his partner count as a link? Once that image had crept back into his thinking, there was no getting away from it. He tried telling himself it was mercy, but that was easy to say, harder to believe. He'd pulled the trigger, even if there'd been no choice. He had his partner's death on his hands. That was the sort of thing that changed a man, forever, for good and bad. Whatever sort of man Julie Gennaro had thought he wasn't. He was something else now. Like it or not, as long as Seth had the murder weapon, he was Lockwood's man. And that meant facing the very real possibility that there would be more blood on his hands before this was over. He followed the red threads to another article, this one about a rumored falling out among thieves, with a new Lockwood rising to fill the power vacuum left by the disappearance of Seth. Gideon Lockwood, Seth's son. At 17, the article claimed, young Gideon had committed more atrocities than any of the generations before him, hiding the worst of his brutality in the ruins of the Blitz. Julie tried to picture it. A new breed of gangster emerging during the horrors of the Second World War to run the streets of London, getting away with murder under the camouflage of the Luftwaffe's nightly bombing raids. All of those images of Londoners coming together at the time of the city's greatest need vanished in rock dust and rubble and opportunity. There was always someone who would look to profit from the pain of others. It was a case of entering the family business with all the ruthless aplomb of the bastard who went before him. It made fascinating reading, but it didn't solve anything. Julie crossed the scorched floorboards again, following another thread. There were 13 scars on the wooden floor. Josh had tried to explain what those marks meant, or at least give him a practical demonstration with that mirror of his, but there had been nothing to see, no matter how insistent Josh had been that he was about to offer up miracles. Julie stood on the same scorch mark that represented the street where he'd last seen Josh turning in desperate circles, looking for something in the glass that wasn't there. Julie Gennaro was drowning, and there was no easy way to save himself. Lockwood had him by the short and curlies. Whatever came next, whatever person emerged, it wouldn't be Julie Gennaro, even if it walked like him, talked like him, shared his past and his face. It wouldn't be him. That Julie Gennaro was dead, and had been from the moment he pulled the trigger to save Taff. This thread took him to an entire wall dedicated to Seth Lockwood's gangland empire, and from that another mosaic of newspaper cuttings obsessed with the missing actress. These things, no matter how exotic they seemed from afar, only ever came down to one of two things, sex or money. He needed to keep it simple. Follow the money. find the lady, or in this case, the lady's bones, and hope some sort of evidence had survived that could be used to bring down the Lockwoods. Good old-fashioned police work. That was what this entire room was all about, even if it got lost in Crazy Town. There were key players in this, and Lockwood was only one of them. There was Isaiah Raines, the stage magician Damiola, the money man Reuben Glass. Follow the money. Find the lady. Lockwood had been so eager for him to believe he didn't want to be here. But if not here, where? He was standing on top of the answer, he realized. Glasstown. Where else? That was where every single thread tangled together in one angry red knot after all. But before he could find a way out of this hell of Lockwood's making, Julie heard the telltale sound of the key in the door downstairs, followed by panicked surprise at the revelation that it had been forced open. Julie counted to five as Josh came running up the stairs, fearing the worst as he raced into the room pumped up on adrenaline. He didn't move. He stood in the midst of the red threads, his feet on two of the anchors, and faced Josh. He had no idea what he was supposed to say. There was a moment, the silence between heartbeats, when Josh clearly couldn't place him. And then he seemed to collapse inwardly, as the fear gave way to recognition.
You! What the fuck are you doing in here?
The subtext being, I thought you were him. I thought you were Seth. I thought he was going to kill me in my own house. How did he answer that? Carefully.
Looking for you. And you just thought you'd break in? Why did you come here? Why not come to the house? I could lie to you, but I won't. I thought about going to the Rothery to find you, but I didn't think you'd be there. I didn't want to turn up on your mum's doorstep and bring more worries for her. But that was only part of it. Lockwood owns the Rothery. If I turned up on your door, he'd know.
He met Josh's doubtful stare and decided to push his luck.
You don't beat a man like Seth Lockwood if he knows you are coming. Now you want to help me? No. I want to understand. You tried to show me something back there. And you didn't want to see it, Josh said. So what's changed?
I gunned down my partner because he was being gorged on by a ravenous sex demon. Because he'd sold himself to the Lockwoods. Because he was corrupt. And now Seth Lockwood has me by the balls and he wants you out of the picture, Julie thought. But he didn't say any of that. Instead, he said,
We both know there's something going on here. I may not understand it, but just because I don't understand, it doesn't mean it isn't happening. That accident, where I picked you up, the two guys in those masks, the comedians, no masks, that's what they were. Who they were. They were fused together at the hand and hip.
Josh corrected him.
Whatever. It was no coincidence. Seth Lockwood was in that cafe, was it? He was waiting for you. He wants to hurt you. And this?
Julie spread his arms to encompass the contents of the room.
All of it, from the floor to the ceiling. This is why, isn't it? I showed you the film. You saw it for yourself. He's not Gideon Lockwood's grandson, despite all appearances, no matter how impossible it sounds. Seth Lockwood isn't just named after Gideon's father. He is his father. You showed me the film. But you still don't believe me, do you?
It wasn't so much an accusation as a statement of disappointed fact. Julie didn't know if he could sell the next part. It's hard to peddle something you didn't believe in.
I don't not believe you, he said, shrugging. Put yourself in my shoes for a minute. It's hard to take it all in. You're talking about a world I'm not familiar with. The kind of stuff you are telling me, long-dead actresses breaking and entering, conjoined comedians hunting you.
He looked down at his feet. Seeing for the first time the distortion of the map and the streets he'd never seen in his London, and put two and two together.
And this,
He jabbed his foot toward one of the anchors, letting Josh assume he knew what it meant.
It's a lot. It's more than a lot. You want me to believe Seth Lockwood is, what, the devil?
Not the devil, Josh said. The devil doesn't exist. Seth does. That makes him so much worse. Julie couldn't help but smile at that. Sound logic.
Then prove it to me. Make me understand, Josh. Because right now all I see are the shadows you're jumping at.
He deliberately turned slightly, his gaze going to Eleanor Raines's beautiful face where it was taped up on the wall.
And a 100-year-old obsession that's anything but healthy.
Josh looked at him. Julie wished he knew what was going through his mind.
Why have you come here? What's changed? You didn't want anything to do with what I had to say. You basically left me to die back there.
He didn't say anything else for a moment, then said,
Bit of an exaggeration, but I take your point. So what happened? I saw the woman who broke into your house.
He swallowed, biting back on the memory of Myrna Shepherd crouching over Taft's corpse, his blood smeared across her lips and chin.
There was nothing natural about her.
Because she isn't. But that's not it. It can't be. You're lying to me, or at least not telling me the truth. He was shaking his head over and over.
You're right, Julie said,
wishing that Josh Raines wasn't half as perceptive or good at reading people as he obviously was. That made it so much tougher to sell him a lie. So he kept it as close to the truth as he could.
He killed my partner right in front of my eyes.
Seth? Julie nodded.
You can't fight him, Josh. He's untouchable. He owns the Rothery and plenty of other places besides. Just think about it for a second. He killed a police officer before my eyes, acting with impunity, knowing I couldn't touch him. That's a special kind of monster. So, ask yourself this. Is it really worth it? All of this? This family feud or whatever it is? Is it really worth dying for? Because he will kill you.
What do you suggest I do?
Walk away.
Is that your advice as an officer of the law?
No. That's my advice as a human being. You didn't see what he did to Taff. It doesn't matter whether he's 30 or 130. This is his town, mate. He might pretend he's not Gideon, and that might be true. But that doesn't mean he isn't a different kind of monster. You can't beat him. None of us can.
I can't walk away, Josh said.
How are you going to fight him?
Josh looked down at his feet. And for a moment, Julie thought it was the cowed gesture of a broken man. It wasn't. Without looking up, Josh Raines said,
I know how it works now. All of it. The grand trick. The great illusion.
I know how he did it. How he spirited away Eleanor. All of it. And I'm going to bring the whole thing crashing down. I'm going to burn it to the ground if I have to. Let him come for me. I don't care. I'm not going to fight fair. I know his weakness.
Okay, then I guess you're going to need some help, Julie said. Wind me up and point me in the right direction. I'm in. I owe it to Taff.
37. The Unseen Realm. January 13. 1924. Damiola had doubts. He had walked a full circuit around the perimeter of the Vale, where this London and the mists of the Anwen brushed up against each other with their barriers at their thinnest. The implications of what Lockwood wanted him to do were dire, and he couldn't pretend otherwise. He barely grasped the full weight of the magic he'd tapped into, though best he could tell the anchors he had developed would force the Vale between here and there to be held open on that side, while closed at the same time on this. In itself, that wouldn't have changed the city, But with his manipulations to push Reuben Glass's failed studio through the veil and act as a bridgehead into the underworld, those anchors would effectively banish the place into limbo forever. Limbo. Purgatory. Hell. The otherwhere. The other world. The underworld. There were so many names for what lay on the other side of the veil. He thought of it as a shadow world, or half-world, even called it mist world, but that was all he ever saw of it. Rolling, endless mists. It was Damiola's belief that those mists had last impacted upon this world in the days of myth, and were responsible for the dragons and demons of all of those impossible stories. But he had no way of proving that. The veil itself ran along intersecting ley lines, which themselves tapped into the elemental power of the land itself, the raw earth magic that was being mercilessly consumed by the revolution of mankind, marking out the anchor points where the lenses would be placed. The planning was meticulous. It had to be. Even a fraction of an inch, an eighth, a sixteenth variation, and the light paths would be off, and the weave would fail. It was that precise. And he couldn't afford to be wrong. Lockwood would kill him if he was. Again. Kill him again. It wouldn't be the first time. Lockwood had come to him 3 months ago with a proposition. He had money behind him, and wanted to use it to make Damiola the most famous performer in the country. He should have been suspicious. All of those clever words and dangled promises, temptation that played on his vanity, the idea that everyone would know him for the innovator he was, putting him up there with the likes of Thurston, Houdini, Robert Houdin, the man Houdini took his name from, the great Lafayette, even Thurston's prodigy, that damned Dane, Harry August Janssen, who wasn't half the magician he was. Cadmus Damiola would have, in a very real way, immortality. Offer the world. You want something major in return. It's simple economics. What Lockwood wanted, no more, no less, was the girl. To think this all started with something as pure as love. They were barely kids, the pair of them, Isaiah and Eleanor, but it had been doomed the moment Isaiah's older brother Seth had decided he needed to take the one thing that made his brother happy and make it, her, his own. He didn't care about the cost. Figurative or literal. It had started with pretty trinkets and flattering words, turning her head with promises of fancy restaurants and West End dance clubs, then diamonds and pearls, and then the ultimate play, once he'd learned the secret yearning of her heart, stardom. She had dreams of the silver screen that eclipsed walk-on parts in low-budget movies, and wanted to stand side by side with Valentino, Flynn, Garbo, and Myrna Shepherd, who she'd met on the set of Number 13, the one day Shepherd was there. They'd barely exchanged a word, but Eleanor Raines had fallen in love with the star every bit as obsessively as Seth had fallen for Eleanor. That was when Seth had thrown his lot in with Reuben Glass and used his connections to help the entrepreneur crystallize his dreams of Glasstown, a huge theatrical studio in the heart of London, and grease the right palms to make it happen. The city was corrupt. Everyone understood that. That there were levels of power that couldn't be reached without a certain amount of ruthlessness, where cash was king and violence its bagman. Seth controlled the streets in the ways that councilmen and cops could only dream, and he offered his influence to Glass in return for one thing. The promise that Eleanor Raines would have the bright lights and leading roles. Glass wanted his dreams so badly he'd agreed. And Seth had taken the promises to his brother's girl. Of course she had been tempted. He'd given her everything she had ever dreamed of, surpassing any promises his younger brother could ever make good on. But Seth hadn't banked on love. She'd refused him. There was one thing she wanted more than fame, more than the bright lights and the promises of stardom. Isaiah. That should have been an end to it. But men like Seth Lockwood didn't take no for an answer. That was how they had got to where they were in this life. That first night when he turned up at the stage door, Damiola had thought he was a fan looking for an autograph, or perhaps to discover the secret of magic, so he'd greeted him with an indulgent smile. He'd listened, But unlike the girl, he'd fallen for the promises and pretty lies, and believed in the illusion Seth wanted him to create. He should have known getting into bed with men like Lockwood and Glass, his life could never be the same again. He had, to an extent. He wasn't naive. What he hadn't grasped was the fact that his death wouldn't be either. Damiola couldn't think properly. He had a show to put on tonight, his swan song. He'd never intended it to end this way, but there was no way he could stay in London after tonight. He needed to get away. Anywhere, it didn't matter. Just far away from this place. Far away from Glasstown. From the outside looking in, Cadmus Damiola had it all. He was on top of the world. The write-ups in the Evening Standard and the London Post had been incredible. The good people of London had fallen for the wonders he had to show them. They gasped in awe at the new worlds the Opticron offered up, not understanding that they were truly seeing other worlds through the lenses that pierced the veil and offered glimpses of paradises and purgatories. They queued around the block for hours for tickets to the matinee performances, hoping for a glimpse of the miraculous. The evening show, 3 weeks before the final curtain call of the tour, had been sold out for months. Life didn't get better than this. Life didn't get worse than this. Satisfied with the sigils and the alignment of the lenses, there wasn't much left for him to do, except prepare for the greatest vanishing act of his life. And he wasn't talking about making part of the city disappear. He headed back to the workshop to run through the tricks one final time, before going to the theater. He walked quickly through the rain-swept streets toward the Adelphi Theater, down on the Strand. The steel tips hammered into his heels, clicking on the cobbled stones as he did. The playbill beside the theater's glass doors promised the Lord of Illusions would confound the mind and delight the heart. The illustrations, meant to hint at the tricks to come, included self-decapitation, levitation, ghostly spirit faces of fallen soldiers, and at the center of them all, the Opticron. The poster boldly proclaimed, "Witness the wondrous Opticron. Watch as it opens windows into fabulous new worlds. Marvel at the miraculous sights it has to show you. You cannot believe your eyes." If only they knew, he thought to himself, going inside. The stage manager nodded to him, offering a polite, "Evening, Mr. Damiola," as the magician swept through the foyer toward the main theater. The lights were low, the stage clear. Hands worked quietly in the background, securing the traps, checking the acoustics and the rigging, and every other eventuality that needed to be in place before the curtain went up. He might be the star of the show, but there were more than a dozen stagehands behind the scenes, making sure the tricks went off without a hitch. The main attraction hung suspended from the ceiling on steel cables. The Opticron. He caught a stagehand's eye and told him to lower it, so that he could give the machine one final check. It took 3 men and twice as long to lower the huge contraption down onto the main stage as it took to raise it. It looked like a huge water boiler, with a dozen peculiar appendages and apertures like a metallic octopus. There were levers and dials, and valves to vent steam when the levers were pumped. It was all smoke and mirrors. None of it was necessary. It was all about putting on a show for the audience, giving them what they expected, which was a huge and powerful machine to look into the future or the past, or wherever wonderful he chose to direct their attention. The truth was, he didn't need tricks. He was what made the machine work. And he could only do that because of what Lockwood had done to him that night down by the Thames embankment, pushing him down beneath the ice, chained up, mocking him to the point of death and beyond, only to have his goons bring him back, coughing and spluttering into the world he'd left behind. The natural laws of the universe didn't apply to the unnatural, which was precisely what he had become, a living dead man. Lockwood had never understood his role in creating the Damiola that stood center stage now. Something had happened in that icy water. It wasn't simply a case of drowning, though that was what had happened. It was the coming back that had changed him. He'd been there, in the darkness, in the mists, newly dead, taking his first steps toward what came after. When he'd been pulled back to this life, the river pumped out of his lungs. And as he choked on that first reborn breath, he'd become a different man. He had seen the face of creation, what some called God, but which was so much more than that, had been touched by the threads of life and death that ran through all things, the spark that is the magic of existence, the ancient energies that hold the world together, and he had grasped his own insignificance in the scheme of things, his place in the mosaic of eternity. He understood now what God was. It was everything, all of us, every life lived, every magical spark, every soul, that at the end came together in the raw energy of the universe, and simply was, the beginning, the end, and everything in between. He had taken up his place in the pattern, only to be ripped out of it, and dragged back down to Earth, forced to live on. How could he not be changed by that? It was late at night, the same night that he had died and returned, and Damiola had been in his workshop, when the white gloves he wore on stage for close-up magic had begun to twitch on the tabletop and move of their own accord. He'd been thinking about an elaborate reworking of the classic rabbit-in-a-hat trick, this one with white doves, and the gloves had responded to his imaginings. The thumbs tangled and knotted, forming a crude head with fingers for wings. The satin bird tentatively took flight, struggling to lift itself at first, as though his doubts held it back, but gradually grew more confident and circled the workshop, with each circuit becoming more and more dove-like in appearance, until finally he threw open the small window upstairs that overlooked Glass's film set, and the impossible bird disappeared through it, banking in the dark sky before it flew off over the make-believe rooftops of that fake city. That was the first time something in his mind came to pass, but it was by no means the last. It was all the little things at first, vague thoughts in his mind that seemed to cause the world around him to suffer until it danced to his tune. The police-issue handcuffs that were the stock-in-trade of his escapology act simply fell away from his wrists. The padlock securing the buckles of the asylum-stamped straitjacket sprung open, the leather straps melting away from the metal buckles. Nothing could contain him, not even a locked coffin. He began to test the limits of enchantment, working through his repertoire of illusions and grand tricks, one by one, until he drove swords through his own body and lived, and locked himself in the water torture cabinet with no hope of escape, and didn't need to because the water couldn't kill him twice. That was when he knew for sure that the stage magician Damiola, Lord of Illusions, was no more. He had died forever in the river, and at the same time, Damiola the magician was born. But it wasn't until he grasped the fundamentals of where that magic was being drawn from that he truly understood the extent of his gift. He was tapping into the mosaic. He was drawing from the divine spark. He was leeching off the raw elemental magic of creation. Damiola possessed a keen scientific mind. He was rigorous in his planning when it came to his act, and methodical in its execution. He needed to understand the mechanicals. That was the way his brain worked. So he approached his new gifts with the same scientific grounding, seeking understanding. In the days after his rebirth, he approached Alcoran, a fakir touring the country with a show that promised to unravel the mysteries of the subcontinent. His own act might have been little more than smoke and mirrors in the early days, but Alcoran offered him his first glimpse of what could only be called true magic, the greatest of which allowed him the grace to leave his body and soul and walk a short way. He studied for 2 months with the fakir, who himself had died and returned in a ritual of rebirth practiced by his people. That was how he knew the secrets of the mosaic, though he had a different name for the Anwen, naming it Alam Gaib, the Unseen Realm. Alcoran taught him that there were certain places in the world where the veil between the unseen realm and their own world was perilously thin, and other places where the sacred geometries intersected in nodes of power. These sacred geometries, as he understood them, followed what the British called ley lines, and were more potent in the open air with grass or dirt underfoot, not the concrete and steel of the New World. The ancient fakir's wisdom humbled Damiola. He learned everything he could, and still felt like he was barely scratching the surface of the old man's knowledge when it came to the old earth magic, but even so he couldn't truly believe until his first opiate-induced soul walk, where his consciousness left his body and rose higher and higher into the heavens, and beneath him saw all of the shimmering energies of the land rippling out in the vibrant colors suffusing the landscape. Then he truly understood the magic of creation, and just how insignificant he was. Even so, he wasn't brave enough to stand against Lockwood. The man was a brutal idiot. He couldn't tell the difference between sleight of hand and proper, genuine, laws-of-physics-defying magic. How was he expected to grasp the idea that by taking Damiola to the other side, then dragging him back again, his thuggery had opened doors that couldn't be closed again? Damiola checked each of the optics in turn, moving around the opticon slowly, content that the world they offered was no farther away than a few streets beyond the theater's walls. Each of the 13 street corners that formed the perimeter of Glasstown and the anchors for his grand enchantment were reflected in the lenses. Everything was in place. All that remained was to wait for the final curtain. Damiola stood in the center of the stage, looking back toward the doors. Banks of red velvet seats tiered up away from him toward the gods. Gilt statues peered on from the sidelines, their golden faces imperious. The place smelled of magic. It was the one place in the world he truly felt alive. Damiola smiled to himself, offering a few practiced flourishes toward the bank of seats, going through the motions. It was hard to imagine that after tonight he would never set foot on a stage again. But, in the immortal words of the Sufi poet Rumi, it is what it is. God help him. There was still time to stop Seth, to back out. Her fate wasn't sealed yet. It was still in his power to influence the outcome of the evening. If he didn't play his part, Lockwood would fail. But what price his betrayal? He wouldn't be any more likely to return to the stage and enjoy the adulation of the crowds. He would never rise to the ranks of the true greats, as his gift so richly deserved. He would become a footnote on the criminal history of the city, a performer fitted with cement shoes and left to feed the fish in the polluted river. Any victory could only ever be Pyrrhic. But was that better than absolute failure and being party to Lockwood's vile enterprise? Yes, undoubtedly. But did he have the balls to go up against the gangster? That was a different question. He'd only know the answer when it came time to act, but he had no faith in his own resolve. He was a weak man. He saw the silhouette of a man waiting in the wings. It took him a moment to make out the familiar features. Seth Lockwood. Damiola breathed deeply, once, twice, three times, steadying himself before he left the stage. As he descended, Damiola cast one last lingering glance up toward the royal box, where more of his backstage team were finishing resetting the props for the evening's penultimate trick, in which a flaming bird, a phoenix, would fly across the stage and disappear as he clapped his hands, bursting into a shower of burning confetti. It was all about timing. There was no magic to it, only artifice, but it was pleasantly visual and grand. "What are you doing here?" Damiola asked, not waiting for his visitor to announce himself. "I didn't trust you to go through with things on your end, so I decided to make sure you didn't have a change of heart." There was no mistaking the menace behind the words. "Everything is in place," he assured Lockwood. "I've paced out the perimeter, I've checked the sigils, I've calibrated the lenses and run the calculations to the nth degree, backward and forward. The numbers are right. The alignment is set. Come midnight, there will be a window of time, an hour, no more, when Glasstown exists in our time stream and out of it. But then, as the hour passes, the anchors will weigh it down one by one, and time will begin to slow within its boundaries. Once that happens, you won't be able to cross in or out of it. You'll be forced to live out your days within the streets of Glass's movie world.
I know all this.